Watch out, here I come.
Welcome to the Lunch Hour with Mr. Credit.
Ooh, hot.
Oh, yeah, that's hot. That is hot.
And today, it's Turnaround Tuesdays.
Let the games begin. Hey-o!
And today, we're teaching you how to point your financial life in the right direction.
Gee, I sure hope there's a happy ending. I love a happy ending.
And now, the Lunch Hour with Mr. Credit on ESPN Radio 1700.
ESPN 1700. My name is Dan Osgood. I am filling in for Derek today. Joining me today, if you're following online, watching us on Mr. Credit TV, you can see Jared Kaza is joining me. He's live via telephone. Jared, are you there?
Yes, sir.
How are you today?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for joining me. I know you got a busy schedule going on there and hard to get out of the office.
Yeah, it's just sometimes you just got to stay chained to the desk to help everyone out, so that'll do. But I can at least go by telephone, so that'll work.
There you go. It's this modern convenience called the telephone.
Yeah, exactly.
Who would have guessed? Today we've got a great show, just a very brief overview. Markets are off. The Dow's down a little over 100 points. Overall, not really that significant, due to the fact that the Dow is at about 16,000. It's still over 16,000, so 100 points is still less than a percent. Not that significant at this point. If you see it getting over a percent, going towards 2%, then it starts looking more serious. And the bond yield, the 10-year bond is down to 2.59 and has been hovering there for a while. Just not a lot going on. I guess Ukraine, Russia, that people are starting to get concerned that that's going to escalate into a much more significant thing. Are you hearing anything out on the streets while you're out at the office today, Jared?
Not at all.
Nothing.
Sorry, I can't come up at the markets. I tend to leave that up to the financial planners and advisors for me.
Yes, and that's as it should be. Good work. Well, Jared Kaza is the estate planning attorney of choice for the Mr. Credit Lunch Hour, and he is also part two, part three for the life plan. The life plan being Mr. Credit's self-stated main purpose in life. He found his calling and is doing everything he can to help people really realize financial peace of mind. And the first couple parts are the financial planning aspect that I can help out with and help you get a clear picture of where you are today in order to map out where you want to go. The next phase is Jared with the estate plan, where you put it in writing, as Derek says.
Exactly right. And like I say, if it's not in writing, it's hard to be enforceable nowadays, but who knows with the video recording and whatnot, but we're going to stick by the old standby and say, put it in writing. That way you can enforce it later.
Right. What one of the best quotes I've heard is a goal is only an idea unless it's written down. And that really applies with estate planning.
Definitely. And you can only do so much with words. And especially after someone's passed away, their words become, you know, memories to some. But they won't hold up in court as well as a signed document that clearly expresses your wants, desires, and goals, as you say.
Right. And you just don't want to leave it up to chance once it gets into courts and there's family bickering going on. If you can write everything down and make it clear what your intentions are, that should make the process a lot easier and remove any of those questions. Well, Jared, I don't know if you've heard this, but being downtown, maybe you have. Minimum wage increase. There's been a lot of talk of that. The White House is really pushing for an increase. But being here in San Diego, we could have some good news, which we can discuss whether it's good news or bad news, but the proposed increases in the minimum wage on a federal level, they got stalled in Congress. But it looks like in San Diego, according to the San Diego Daily Transcript, on the same day the U.S. Senate was blocked from passing a proposal to raise the federal minimum wage to $10.10 per hour, a committee of the San Diego City Council moved forward on a plan to raise the local minimum wage to $13.09 per hour by 2017. Have you heard anything about that?
I did catch wind of that. Yeah, I actually saw a little article on it. And speaking about the merits of it, well, one, I do like the fact that the city has taken it upon itself to actually do what the council is do what it's elected to do, which is to lead and to govern and make decisions. I am not a fan of a federally mandated edicts, if you would, especially when you're talking about something like minimum wage. Obviously, the cost of living in San Diego and San Francisco and some of these other towns that have either have passed local minimum wage laws or floating the idea is a lot different than, say, Decatur, Alabama. Okay. So, I mean, I think it's good from a standpoint that this should be a local issue or state issue in determining what a minimum wage should be because, like you said, the cost of living varies so much in our well-diverse country. And I like it from that angle. With respect to its impact on the economy, that's just the second phase. You got to see how this would apply and potentially hurt businesses currently in San Diego, the city of San Diego, and those businesses looking to come into the city of San Diego to transact business.
Right. It's kind of a catch-22 because I absolutely see the value of increasing minimum wage, making it easier. We are in California. Either coast, you really can't really lay a blanket statement and say this is the norm. We are the extremes on each side of the country. Middle America is very different, so a minimum wage of $8 or $10 may go much further. But here, everybody who lives here knows the cost of living in San Diego, the tax we pay for the sunshine that we have most every day out here is pretty substantial. So the upside is the wages to the employees. The downside is now additional costs going to the employer and the impacts that could have not only on employment costs, but now they're going to have to raise the cost or the prices of the goods that they have or they're producing in order to offset that. Because if not, then it could potentially cause a business to start making zero profit or even losing money if they're having to pay out this mandatory higher wage.
Exactly. I mean, it's a simple math. If you're going to increase your expenses, which would include payroll in this case, if you're increasing the minimum wage you're paying to your employees, you either have to sell more product, which, again, that's not necessarily something you can control, or cut expenses somewhere else, whether that means you raise minimum. You have 10 employees at a certain current rate, you raise minimum wage. Now you have to cut 2 employees so it balances out. That's a possibility. So you're trying to pass benefits on to the employees, but could cause an effect where some of these employees will now be unemployed as a result because you can't just print the money. It's a finite amount based on what you're selling. Exactly right. The other alternative is moving the business. I've seen an exodus of sorts of some California businesses over the last couple of years to more business-friendly states such as Texas that offer large tax incentives for operating your business in the state, and you also have less of the environmental regulatory expenses in states like Texas and Middle America, as you mentioned, as opposed to the states on the coastlines.
Right, and if you look at Texas, they're putting out a pretty aggressive campaign trying to lure businesses, especially from California, to Texas.
Oh, yes, definitely, very much so. Tech industry, you name it. Texas is putting on a pretty aggressive campaign to exactly what you mentioned, to lure California business into Texas so that their tax revenues and whatever else can be dispersed among the Texas populace and leave Californians to themselves.
And I have to give the governor there a lot of credit. That's a pretty smart idea. It doesn't help California, but it sure helps his own state. And it probably in the long run helps a lot of these businesses because California really isn't the most business-friendly state there is.
No, as we mentioned, you have the increased taxes, you have the environmental regulations and other regulations that are imposed in California that are not so imposed in other states, and the fact that California is a very litigious state. You have to have a bankroll of sorts earmarked for potential lawsuits, whether they're from employees or from consumers. California is a great state for other reasons, but when we're talking about businesses and keeping them there, it is not a what I would call a business-friendly state when compared to Texas, Florida, and some of these other states in our union.
Right. If you want to say anything about them, they are definitely an employee-friendly state. Like they, all the laws and the enforcement of laws are really centered around helping employees and looking out for the employees over the business. And I this could be another step that way. And don't get me wrong, I think increasing the wages is an important step. But if they need to come up with a number that doesn't impact the business in such a negative manner that it's going to cause the business, one, to start laying off a lot of their employees just because the cost associated with those employees is too great, or looking to relocate, because that's not going to help the local economy in any manner.
Not at all. And again, this is why it's beautiful that they're starting at the local level, because you can kind of control the consequences or the, you know, of the change at a local level rather than passing a federal or state mandate, which would have a lot more dire consequences if they are negative. Again, if it's positive, there's a boom. But again, by testing it out, as it were, at the local level, then you can kind of predict how it would be applied as we go to state and federal and up the chain of command.
Right, provided the illustrious leaders can look down and see what's happening here and use that as kind of their test market. These politicians don't tend to follow things like that and pay much attention, it doesn't appear, with a lot of their decision-making.
Yeah, well, if we're talking about Congress in general, yes, that's true. I would agree with that.
you know, they're good, useful people. They're constantly campaigning.
Exactly. We talked about that a lot on the show.
Yep. One of these days, although I have no interest in running for any public office or anything of the sort, but one of these days, maybe some of our ideas could be heard and they'll step back and say, wow, those make sense.
Well, the only way you're going to learn it is if you speak it, and that's what we do here, and that's what Mr. Credit's all about, making everyone smarter than everyone else.
That's right. And when you're ready to run, I will endorse you.
All right.
Up to the limitations of what my profession will allow.
Sure.
You look good. Jared for president.
Oh, boy.
You don't think?
I don't know.
Yeah. All right. And another other side note, something that I've been seeing more prevalence lately, a lot of these big hedge fund managers are coming out and either touting this company or talking about how they're getting involved or bad-mouthing a company. And it's clearly for their own gain. In an article by CNBC, David Einhorn, who's a big hedge fund manager, came out and flat out said he's betting on Athena Health to fall. And he called it a bubble stock. It hit a peak of around $205. After this story came out, it's down $18 and change today. It's down at $108 already. And when you're shorting something, basically you borrow it from someone and sell it on that day, hoping that it's going to go down, because then you can go back out in the open market, buy it at the lower price, and then give it back to the person that you borrowed it from, and you keep that difference. So with his hedge fund, obviously he is shorting a large number of shares of Athena Health, and just by him coming out talking about it, he's profiting. Where, Jared, if you or I were to do something like that, we're going to have people knocking on our doors probably before the day's over, not even waiting till tomorrow.
Exactly. It just shows you the power being wielded on Wall Street and with our investors and the companies and their impact, even by the what they say on CNBC or anywhere. Just the it's got legs, as they say, the consequences and the effects of these gentlemen and ladies on Wall Street.
Right. And I don't know. This type of thing really hits a chord with me, really upsets me. The good news could be that he's saying it could drop as much as 80%. It hit a high of 205. It's already been almost cut in half. So maybe this will backfire on him, and maybe that's why he's trying to badmouth it so it'll continue to drop. But maybe it's already had its negative run, and he's late to the game, and it's going to turn around and bite him. And that would be nice to see for once. Well, stick around. When we get back, estate planning for plants? We'll see. We'll discuss it as soon as we get back. You're listening to the Mr. Credit Lunch Hour, ESPN 1700.
If you would like free advice from Mr. Credit, just call or text 619-786-7853. That's 619-786-7853.
Welcome back to the Lunch Hour with Mr. Credit. And today, it's Turnaround Tuesday on ESPN Radio 1700.
Welcome back to your Lunch Hour. It is Mr. Credit Lunch Hour with ESPN 1700. My name is Dan Osgood. I'm filling in the hot seat for Derek today. On the line, I've got Jared Kaza with Neil Dimott downtown. Jared is the estate planning of choice for the Mr. Credit show, and I believe you have worked with Derek on numerous issues.
Yep. We've done Derek on some business as well as his estate planning issues as well. So, yes, we gives us a little bit more credibility. We're not just some talking head for Derek. We actually help him out as well, so you can attest to it.
You've got skin in the game.
Exactly.
All parts. Good. Estate planning. This is, I guess, step three. Is that, do I have the steps in order?
That is correct. We're step three of the life plan. Exactly right. After they talk to you about the finances and figuring out, you know, what is in my estate? What am I looking at? What are some options into investing that and securing it and securing my goals? Then they come to us so we can protect it.
Right. Make sure everything is in proper order once they know what they have. And that's those first couple steps. If you can get those out of the way and do those, that is a giant leap towards just that financial peace of mind that we're trying to create with this life plan. When Derek came and talked with us about the whole idea, it was a very exciting effort to try to put the pieces together, because it's something I see every day. I'm sure it's something you see every day. And it's vitally important to that financial peace of mind.
Exactly. And the point we'd like to emphasize is it sounds like it's a lot of work at first because you're trying to consolidate all the information that may or may not already be in order. But once it's done, you have kind of a template. You have everything organized. You can structure the trust and the will and all the other documents as part of our estate plan packaged together. Then it gives you the foundation to be able to benefit yourself later on and to know that, well, even if you don't do anything else from this day forward, at least you've done, you know, more than the average person in ensuring that your affairs are in order and you have that financial security.
Oh, absolutely. It does take a tiny bit of work to gather some data to start with. And then once you get through the first few steps, you can almost put it on cruise control and then just periodically review it if you choose. And like you said, if you don't need to, or if you don't choose to ever go back and do much, you've got the basics, the good, strong base of foundation in place where you don't need to do a lot unless there's major, major changes in the future.
Exactly.
You're going to be in good shape.
Those basic steps are enough to avoid the court system, the delays and the costs that associated with just having a will or not having anything put in place that you read about in the news. That's, you know, a wealth to itself.
Okay, here's a good one for you, and I'll have to ask you this first. What is the strangest item, whether it's an animal, car, or whatever, that you have drawn up documents for to make sure that they get properly taken care of? Or are you allowed to disclose?
I don't know. Nothing unique comes to mind. Just in discussing certain, I wouldn't say charitable gifts, but gifts that of certain items of personal property be utilized in a certain manner in accordance with the deceased's wishes to ensure that gets passed on. I haven't had one of these headline stories that we're going to talk about here with plants.
No alligators or anything fun like that someone's been passing?
No, nothing to that effect yet. Not a lot of the... I haven't set up a pet trust yet, although I was schooled in it, and that's kind of, you know, you set up the trust to take care of a loving pet in case something happens to you. And I guess what we're going to talk about here with the plant is basically very similar to the pet trust in that regard.
Yeah, I saw the headline and thought, we'll have to talk about this. And the most common thing people set aside is money, property, and the normal everyday items. In some conscientious people will try to do some set aside or some providing for their pets. because pets in this day and age are becoming more and more like a part of the family. They are part of the family, so I understand that. This article from MarketWatch, the woman in Pittsburgh, a 63-year-old woman, Rana Skoratow, is setting aside a $5,000 bequest so that a friend can care for her enormous philodendron after her death. Apparently, it's not that uncommon for someone with a green thumb. After all, there are apparently numerous plants that routinely live 70 years or longer. And, of course, when people inherit them, they realize that in order to keep that plant alive, it's going to cost a little bit of plant food.
Exactly. And this is, I mean, I like this. This is brilliant. This is exactly why we have the laws and the freedom to contract we have. This individual wants to care for her plant. It's her money. She should be entitled to do so and be able to provide instructions for someone else to take care of her plant. It's not that dissimilar, if you think about it, from someone who owns a piece of raw land or agricultural property. I mean, you give them the property, say it's 20 acres. You're going to have trees and other bushes and stuff on there. Your hope is that your heirs and beneficiaries will care for the property and maximize profitability if that's what it's used for. Here, if you have an apartment or live in a condo, you don't have trees and other shrubberies, but you do have a prized plant. Well, why should you be denied the right to take care of that and to see that living organism grow and to its fullest? I think it's perfect, and the system allows you to do so. The only thing that you bring up that's interesting is the fact that some of these specific plants live for hundreds of years, and if we can create documents that can be well enforced 100-200 years from now, you get into the more technical realm of trust and estate. You're talking about enforceability issues there, but as a general nature, I don't think there's a problem with the plant trust, rather, and rather, I think it's a rather good thing.
Right. It really emphasizes anything that's important to you, you can take steps to protect that and have control over what happens with that. Like this article kind of hits home a little bit. My mother-in-law, she loves her plants and her gardening, and I could absolutely see her doing something like this because they're very important to her. She goes out every single day, rain or shine, and goes out and plays in her garden, and that's a big part of every one of her days. And I can see value there where that's one of the most important things to her that keeps her going. And why not take a step that would give her, again, peace of mind to know that when something happens to her, that her plants are going to be cared for?
Exactly right. And I will say the only a couple exceptions to the rule here is, of course, if you really enjoy to do illegal things, you can't contract to do that or fire someone to do that.
So. As far as I know, she's not growing anything like that out in the yard. But
okay, well, I'm just as general. You may have things near and dear to your heart, but I mean, when you're talking about contracting rights and what you have the right to contract to, illegality is one of those things you can't compel on someone, but. That aside, yes, you're right. I think your mother and your mother-in-law would be perfectly happy with something like this.
Now, with something like this, the challenges would be you bequest $5,000 to the neighbor to take care of the plant.
Likely what they did is request $5,000 to the neighbor to be held in trust or earmarked specifically for use for the plant
food or whatever. So
exactly.
So there's no, well, here's $5,000. I don't care about the plant. The plant's done. I mean,
you can do it one or two ways. We do this a lot in our trust because some people don't want to put extra burdens on their beneficiaries. For example, in that scenario, $5,000 given to the neighbor to be used to care for the plant, for example. Mm-hmm. We can either word the document in one of two ways. One is, I give my neighbor $5,000. I desire you to use it on the plant, but there's no obligation there. If you give you $5,000, quote, in trust or specifically to be used for it, then you're creating a fiduciary duty on the beneficiary to only use that funding for the purpose of the plant. You may ask, well, what's to guarantee them from running off and taking the money and doing something else with it? It really isn't for the person because they're no longer alive, but at least at that point, the beneficiaries and someone else with knowledge, if they know that the trust was created for that specific purpose, and they could be a potential successor beneficiary or something, they actually could bring an action in court to, you know, get the money back or get the trustee in trouble for mismanaging the funds. Now, you may think that's silly. We're only talking about $5,000. But when you start talking about pet trust for, you know, multi-thousand dollar, you know, trust set up for kids and everything else, the same rules apply.
Yeah, so this is just on a real small scale.
Yeah.
And it just escalates depending on what it is. Children, pets, special needs children, whatever it may be, those numbers just increase dramatically.
Mm-hmm. Exactly right.
Okay, so really, what would happen in the case, say I was appointed to look after this plant, and beyond my control, the plant gets a bug that kills it,
mm-hmm.
and that money's there. Does that money then get taken back into the estate if that plant is no longer there, or would that be a provision?
Well, you raise a good point. Depending on how the trust is drafted, now, this is one of my stickling points when I draft trust, is I always got to find the end of the road. You know, if someone dies, where does that share go? Does it fall to that person's estate? If the trust purpose is extinguished, which in this case the plant dies, this trust purpose for that money, being the care of the plant, is no longer in existence. That money must revert back to the trust, the master trust that we set up for the deceased, and then according to its terms, it would be distributed accordingly. So typically, if it were me, the way I draft it would be name the caretaker of the trust as the alternate beneficiary.
Okay.
If it were just me giving recommendations. But again, whatever the trust document says there is where that leftover funding is going to go.
Okay. Well, stick around. You are listening to the Mr. Credit Lunch Hour on ESPN 1700. When we get back, we will discuss how more constitutional rights are being violated.
If you would like free advice from Mr. Credit, just call or text 619-786-7853. That's 619-786-7853.
Welcome back to the Lunch Hour with Mr. Credit. And today, it's Turnaround Tuesday on ESPN Radio 1700.
Welcome back to your Lunch Hour. My name is Dan Osgood. I'm filling in for Mr. Credit. I have got Jared Cazzo with Neil Dymott Attorneys downtown. Jared, you still hanging around with me?
Yes, I am, sir.
Good to hear. I don't know if you've tuned in, Mr. Credit TV. We do have you here with us.
Oh, nice.
So you may want to check that out when you get a chance. So constitutional rights, we talk about this, seems like on a weekly basis. How they're being violated or how they're being upheld. Seems like more often than not they're being violated these days than being upheld.
Seems like it, but we'll see.
Yeah. Well, the interesting article that you passed along to me, a Florida school teacher humiliated a 12-year-old boy in front of an entire class after she caught him reading the Bible during free time. This is in Fort Lauderdale. And this student, during free time, so they had their choice of any book. He was reading his Bible because he got it for Christmas, and it's been a very prized possession for him, and he reads it whenever he has free time. And apparently the teacher took it a step further and called the family's home. No one answered, so she left a nice message that was quoted, "I noticed that he has a book, a religious book, in the classroom. He is not permitted to read those books in my classroom." How does that work, Jared?
Well, I mean, I don't know what the school's policies are and whatnot, but the reason I passed it on was just to highlight what you emphasized already, which is, look, this is a little kid. He's reading a book during his free time. It's not that the school's teaching or, you know, the teacher is not reading from the book, for example, the Bible, that is.
Right.
To the students, the whole idea that separation of church and state, we don't want the system's been upheld through court system, court cases and everything throughout the years, that public institutions should not be educating the children with respect to one religion over another. So in doing so, the Bible and certain of its teachings are not in the public school curriculum, per se. But again, the reason I was focused on this article in particular is that you're dealing with a little boy that's reading something on his own free time, privately to himself, quietly, and the school has, and the teacher decided that couldn't do that, which prompted me to ask, you know, when did we become a nation of atheists of sorts that we can't have any religion in the school system or at all? Whereas, you know, I thought rather that the First Amendment here, talking about freedom of religious expression, was that everyone has the right to express their religion independently, free from any chastisement from the government, which would include public education system, so long as, you know, you're not, you know, creating doctrine or teaching it to the students. So again, it was just another instance where I thought it was noteworthy, something that Mr. Credit would have talked about himself.
Oh, for sure.
It's because it's pretty clear, at least from the article. You never know if there's omissions or.
Well, that's another issue entirely with the fact finding of our national and local media nowadays.
Right. It does look like they've tried to pursue this, according to some of the quotes. But this was during a 90-minute free reading session. Maybe that's a daily thing that the kids are entitled to, just to practice reading and continue to educate themselves. And if apparently free reading doesn't mean free reading.
Yeah, I guess not. And I guess arguably you could say, look, the books, you can't read any book. It's not above your level, or there's certain other content in there. But again, he's a 12-year-old. He's a sixth grader, so I wouldn't say that the Bible, per se, from a reading standpoint, is out of his league. Obviously, the gift giver thought it wasn't within his league, so mm-hmm. There was no issue there. I think I saw a comment either in the article or somewhere else was, look, if another student was reading something like 50 Shades of Grey or something, would they have said anything? Who knows? But I think that the point I wanted to make was that it just seems like the public school system's emphasis that the Bible cannot even be visible in the school system by itself without any other, you know, anything else related to it is just going a little bit overboard, and it just prompted me to state, well, why is it okay to prevent the Bible in these cases from being utilized by a student in his own free time privately, and, you know, it's not, certain other things are allowed.
Right. I guess on the other side, you could maybe make a case, and maybe this would be a school's approach, is in this day and age, because there is so much talk along these lines of the separation, that they're maybe overreacting and panicking because he had it there. They don't want anyone else to interpret that they're encouraging this in the school.
You know, that very well may be. I mean, and because of the litigious nature of our society and the assertion of certain rights and freedoms and the erosion of the right to our rights to freedom of speech and privacy has been demonstrated through just tabloid news, it could very well be that school is being proactive in quelling problems before they start. I just don't agree with the method that went around doing it. But you're right. You make a very good point there, that maybe they've exhausted all kinds of remedies at this point, and this is where they've reached to, and we have to deal with it at that level.
Right, just draw a line that...
It could be.
Rather than...
A good point. And again, I'm only getting this from the article as well, so I don't know all the facts. But again, it's just one of those topics that I think is ripe for debate, and should always be right for debates as long as we live here in this country.
Absolutely. And again, you've touched on it a couple times. This is a 12-year-old kid not doing anything wrong, minding his own business. Knowing most classrooms, I'll bet there was a handful of kids that were acting up, not even doing what they're supposed to, and they probably didn't get any attention. And this poor kid who's sitting there just because of the panic around church and state,
mm-hmm.
got the brunt of what could be an unfortunate situation. It could be a misunderstanding. I don't know, because we're here in California and this is out in Florida, that we'll overhear much more of this, but it would be interesting to see what the final outcome is.
Yeah, it will be. But again, not going either way, but I just, again, bring up these issues to the table so we can discuss them and hopefully evolve from them.
Correct. Well, that is Jared Kaza with Neil Dimott Downtown. Is the best number the main line, Jared, people
sir.
To get a hold of you? Is that 619-238-1712?
That is correct.
That's correct. And that'll just ask for Jared. Once again,
you can say you're looking for your. Well, I would mention the show one. We're trying to keep track of everyone who's listening to this show coming in.
Okay.
So that you are a listener of Mr. Credit, and then you give them my name, or even just the fact you're looking to do an estate plan. That should be enough.
Okay, and your offices also handle all varieties of legal issues as well, right?
Yeah, we're a full-fledged civil litigation firm. We do not do any tax matters, no criminal cases, but we do handle a wide variety of civil litigation matters and are known for actually taking cases to trial. So if there's something on those lines there, we probably have an attorney here that could help out as well.
Okay, and these are all top-notch people, folks. So if you do have any legal matter, I would recommend calling this number and speaking with these people, at least for a consultation to find out what's available to you. And once again, that's number 619-238-1712. Mention the Mr. Credit show, and Jared will meet with you and give you a good consultation and point you in the right direction towards financial peace of mind, which is the goal. That is our life plan. Well, Gary Becker, probably a name almost no one knows about. He was an important economist, Nobel Prize winner in 1992. And he was known for thinking a little bit different, thinking very different from the normal economic views, and that's part of why he won the Nobel Prize. He basically studied human capital, and conventional wisdom overall held that people commit crimes because of discrimination, overly strict fathers, capitalist oppression, or the exploitation of the working class. Gary Becker, on the other hand, put all these simplistic views aside and just applied the free market principle that people have an incentive to pursue their self-interest not only as producers and earners, but also outside the workplace. And that meant people commit crimes more often when they perceive that the benefits outweigh the costs. So basically he was saying better policing to apprehend criminals and harsher sentences would result in less crime because they raise the potential costs of the crime. And it always is in everything you do, risk versus reward. If the risks of getting caught are not bad, the reward is always going to be much greater. And so he will be missed in the economic circles. So I just wanted to say, rest in peace, Gary. I have read a lot of what he has done, and very insightful. Well, stick around. Is 7 million the new 1 million? We'll discuss when we come back.
If you would like free advice from Mr. Credit, just call or text 619-786-7853. That's 619-786-7853.
Welcome back to the Lunch Hour with Mr. Credit. And today, it's Turnaround Tuesday on ESPN Radio 1700.
Thanks for listening. It is your Lunch Hour with Mr. Credit. My name is Dan Osgood. I'm filling in for Mr. Credit himself. On the hot seat, sitting in here with Jared Kaza from Neil Dymock. Jared, still doing well? Hanging with me?
I'm still here, sir. No problem.
Excellent. Very quickly, article in CNBC. Best places to retire. So go to CNBC, type in best places to retire. There's an article. They did a survey. Bankrate.com did an overall survey to find the best states for retirement based on a number of factors. And any guesses without cheating?
No, I already saw the article, so I couldn't do that.
Would you have guessed South Dakota before you read the article?
I don't think that would have been my top choice. I would have definitely not considered Florida necessarily the number one, though, as the title of the article suggests. But probably wouldn't have got South Dakota.
Okay. Yeah, because things you normally think about, people want to retire somewhere where it's warm, comfortable, relaxing. Florida, Arizona, California would pop to the top of that. People that live here know it's pretty expensive to live here. Basically, South Dakota for a low cost of living, low crime rate, low tax burden, and quality health care. And basically, people who live there are very happy in their communities, which that looks like five or six good reasons for me where I would consider that.
Oh, exactly right. Yeah, and I'm looking at the article now, and it says the other states up there with South Dakota were its neighbors: Colorado, Utah, North Dakota, and Wyoming.
Well, Colorado, with the recent law passes, that could get a new wave of people wanting to retire there for additional reasons in addition to what we've listed.
Yeah, it could be, but I mean, I as a former resident of Colorado, or resident of Colorado where I went to law school, I say that Colorado's a great state, at least for the reasons stated in this article.
But I know a number of people that live there, and they just love it, and it's one of the more beautiful states I've probably been to in my life. Arizona and Florida didn't even make the top 10. Arizona was 16, Florida being 39th. On the opposite end, the five states that ranked the lowest, Hawaii, Arkansas, Alaska, West Virginia, and New York, which New York came in at number 50, which I guess that wouldn't surprise anyone.
I guess not. I don't know. It's a little surprising, I think, because you think of New York. But you have typically, when you think of New York, I guess you just think of the city and not necessarily the whole state as a
right.
whole. But again,
upstate's very beautiful and very different than New York itself.
Yeah, exactly. But I think when you're looking at the factors considered, cost of living, tax burden, and some other issues there, it's not surprising New York is down towards the bottom.
Right. And Alaska, probably just because of the overall weather. It's probably a little chilly for retired folks. They tend to want a little bit warmer weather than that.
That and the fact that you're so far removed from everything else, it's burdensome.
Absolutely. Well, on Yahoo Finance, another interesting article that brings up a question. Is $7 million like the new $1 million? Because you have always heard over the years, if you can just save $1 million, you can retire comfortably. And the reality is, if someone were to retire today with $1 million, depending on what their spending habits may be and what their goals are, what they want to do in life, $1 million can go a long, long way. You could safely withdraw approximately $43,000, $44,000 a year and not really deplete that to where you would ever run out of money, barring any big catastrophic healthcare issue that would all of a sudden gobble up all that money. But today, 20-year-olds, to make just a fair comparison, they will need closer to $7 million to have the same lifestyle when they retire. Whereas back, if you look backwards to 1970, you would have only needed $166,000 to retire and have the same or similar purchasing power versus today's dollar. With your estate planning, you probably don't get to see a lot of that, Jared?
No, not so much. I don't get into compound interest and different right. structures of valuation. Our focus is more on ensuring that whatever you do have in your portfolio, in your 401k and your retirement plan, goes where you want it to go, and in some cases can reduce some of the withdrawal and tax penalties. When you're talking about naming your spouse as your primary beneficiary of your 401k plan so they can roll it over into their account and have other options, and naming the trust as the backup beneficiary to ensure that that money gets distributed according to your overall estate planning goals.
Okay. With some tax, not benefit, but tax-advantaged positioning and transfer.
It can. I don't want to speak so much on the tax incentives there, because it's more of an accountant and financial planning area. I get into trouble sometimes if I try to give too much tax advice, or not necessarily tax advice, but just some instructions. So I do know that the benefits of the spouses are primary when you're talking about naming beneficiaries to these types of plans.
Right, there's so many options available to a spouse versus a relative. That's right. Not your spouse.
But you hit it on the head. I don't get into this realm so much as I would say it's more your field or an right. accountant's field. Again, our goal is step three of the life plan is just to ensure that whatever is there goes where you want it to go and doesn't get shuffled back up to Sacramento, to the Hungry Bear, or to Uncle Sam in the federal estate tax.
Right. Well, the gist of this article, and again, it's from Yahoo Finance, and I think the title is $7 million. Is it the new $1 million? And basically, for example, to really emphasize the importance of starting saving early and the effect of compound interest, with Mr. Credit and I, we talk about this all the time, the importance of getting that money working for you as early as possible and just let it grow on top of itself. And that's where it turns into very significant amounts of money. To show an example, in order to get to $7 million, a 25-year-old with a starting salary of roughly $50,000 would need to save just under 15% of their salary throughout their entire career. That is assuming a 4.5% inflation rate, which is higher than the average. Over a long period of time, the average is just over 3%. Right now, according to the Fed, to the government, it's only about 1.5%. So if it were to stay at this low level, if you had $7 million, you're going to be able to do everything you wanted and much, much more. You wouldn't need nearly as much. But that's a pretty substantial amount of money to be saving, 15%. You always hear 10% as kind of a baseline to get you to a point where you want to be. And this one, I don't know if it gets you there or how hard it would be, because saving 15% is much more challenging than 10%. Most people can figure out a way to get 5 or 10% put aside, but going much more than that is starting to stretch a lot more. The example also goes on to say, if inflation hovered more around the normal, that 3%, then you would really only need about $4 million rather than 7. But the best example that really emphasizes the point of this article is, let's use a fictional saver. There's, say, this woman, Jennifer. She's 22 years old, earning $3,000 a month, and decides to save just 5% of her pre-tax salary in her 401k, which we emphasize over and over. If you have a 401k available to you and your company matches, you should at the bare minimum be contributing what your company matches, because that's just free money your company gives you. I don't know your situation there at Neil, but Dimot, if they've got a 401k with matching, but if so, I hope you're taking advantage of that, Jared.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure there's a contributing factor. I don't know if it's a complete match, but I know that there is a percentage of whatever you contribute goes towards it. And like you say, exactly right. If you got to take advantage of these benefits that are available to you earlier when you're making the salary and when you're able to do work and everything else before you need it, again, that's the whole idea of the planning elements to steps 2 and 3 of the life plan, is to plan before you need it. And then if you've done your work, like the grasshopper, no, is it the grasshopper or the ant? There's no parable there.
I believe it's fable. The ant.
It's the ant, I think, prepares, and then you'll be fine.
Right. Well, this goes on. So she gets a 5% match from her employer, so she's putting away $300 a month. To some people, that could be a lot. To some, it's not as much. But if you can do that, and just assume a 6%, which would be fairly risky, not extremely risky, but not extremely conservative, which would probably be appropriate for someone 22 years of age. If we assume she never gets a single raise or a promotion, so she only makes $3,000 a month for her entire working career, she will have saved over $750,000 in that retirement account by age 65. If she were to do the same thing but wait, so say at age 35, she's had two promotions, income $6,000 a month, she's saving, she would have put away twice as much, she would only end up with $317,000. And it's all about the compounding interest and the importance of that.
And that's why it's important to talk to you guys.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, that about does it today. Time flies when we're having fun. Jared, with Neil Dimot, thanks again very much.
Thank you for having me, and you guys take care.
Okay. Have a great day, everyone. You've been listening to The Lunch Hour, your lunch hour, Mr. Credit Radio, ESPN 1700.
If you would like to contact Mr. Credit or access any free offers mentioned on the show, just go to MrCredit.org. That's MrCredit.org.